It's a movement, but it's about people. Be the People is about we the people joining forces to reclaim and reshape the best of our nation's time-treasured traditions. Each week, we offer insightful interviews with movers and shakers from all different spheres of life. And now, please welcome Dr. Carol Swain.
We have an exciting and very important topic today. It's bioethics. In March of 2017, Joe Carter, he's an editor with NIV Life Hacks Bible, he wrote an important article for the ERLC on basic bioethics and what every Christian should know. And ERLC stands for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Council of the Southern Baptist Convention. And the study of bioethics is concerned with issues like abortion, cloning, euthanasia, human, animal, embryo research, and much more. And it's all about the dignity and worth of human beings created in the image of God. Now, joining me today is a fellow Christian who is the executive director of the Tennessee Center for Bioethics and Culture. And so let's welcome Joy Riley to the Be the People show. So hello, Joy. How are you today?
Hello, Carol. I'm very fine. Thank you for having me on today.
Well, Joy, we've known each other for a number of years, and so I know that you deal with issues that are weighty that a lot of us Christians don't think a lot about. We think about these issues when they cross our path. We think about them when they cross our paths, but we don't always think about them in terms of the big ethical issues about life and death and humanity. So this morning, I'd like for you to tell us in your own words about bioethics and even how you became involved. What's your background?
Okay, thank you. Well, bioethics is a compound word, and it's not been around that long, maybe 4 or 5 decades. It basically combines the term for life, bio, with ethics. And as you know, ethics is about moral goodness. It's about right attitudes, right conduct, and right character. So bioethics is how to think and act in a morally good way toward issues of life or about issues of life. I became interested, honestly, fairly early on. I was in college, and the man, Dr. Richard Barber, who taught medical ethics at the University of Louisville Medical School, taught at the University of Louisville undergraduate campus. And so I took his course in medical ethics as an undergrad. And I had quite a bit of philosophy training in my undergrad as well. And then in medical school, I took the medical ethics course. Again, it was an elective course there. Interesting to know. But in truth, most of my mentors, my attendings, taught ethics as a way of life. So it was something you absorbed from the environment, if you will, as well as didactic lessons in the classroom. So after medical school and residency and some post-residency training and such, I continued to be interested in ethics. Then I had some time away from medicine, and I wanted to be able to speak to ethical issues. And a number of people, when they have advanced training, can speak very well in their discipline. But if you don't have more training and a lot of knowledge, reading, et cetera, in the other areas, then you probably shouldn't be too vocal in your opinions. That was my take on it at any rate. So I wanted to be able to address ethical issues, and I knew that I needed more training. So I went back and did a master's in bioethics and wrote a thesis on the stem cell research and cloning debate in the UK, the US, and Germany.
What year was this that you got your degree?
I finished my thesis at the end of 2004, and my degree was awarded in May of 2005.
And before that, what was your background?
I have a medical degree, so I did medicine at the University of Kentucky and then residency at Washington University in St. Louis.
I think it's interesting that you, I guess as a scholar and as a medical doctor, you felt like you had to become a specialist before you could talk about these issues.
I did.
But you were wrong, right?
Apparently.
No, because I think a lot of us have strong opinions, but we're not able to talk about it in the realm where you write about it, you talk about it, you actually position where you could help change policy. So that's the difference between you and me. I can talk all day, but you have equipped yourself where people will listen.
Well, but you have equipped yourself because you have such an incredible background in policy and law and a variety of other things as well. So, yes, it's about learning the language. And then because we all have opinions and the point of my training is to help people think through the issues, not to give them my opinion so much as to present the data, present the arguments. And yes, I do have an opinion about it, but to help them think through the issues. And you do that in your own field. I'm always amazed when I'm with you, Carol, too. It's always iron sharpening iron. I appreciate that.
But tell us, Joy, what do you see as the most pressing ethical concern that Christians should be focused on? Because the abortion has been around, it's been around like forever, but
right.
It seems like in some ways we're winning that battle. There's a long way to go, but we're still winning that battle. But there are other things like the cloning, the euthanasia, the human animal embryo research, and there's some, and what am I missing? I mean, I'm telling you the ones that I know about, but what else am I missing there?
Well, let me give you a little scaffolding, if you will, a rubric to help you think through some of these things or to think about them. One of my mentors, Dr. Nigel Cameron, was fond of saying that bioethics includes these primary realms. And they're not all inclusive, but it's a nice little way of remembering some of the things that bioethics touches. And he said it was making life, taking life, and faking life. That's with an F. First of all, making life would include anything from assisted reproductive technologies like IVF, free parent embryos, cloning, hybrids, and chimeras. Taking life, as you alluded to, would include abortion and euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, and a variety of euphemisms that are used for that, like MAID, the medical aid in dying. So that would be taking life. And then faking life would be things like life extension technologies that go well beyond our usual 80 to 90 years or so.
Could you explain a little more about that? Like, how common is that? Life extended?
Well, it's not terribly common, but it is. It does have some place in the culture, and newsworthy often. You're thinking about things like cryogenics, where people want to freeze their brains and then have them uploaded to computers. Transhumanists like Ray Kurzweil. Nick Bostrom. Ray Kurzweil wrote the book called Singularity, and he's talking about the point at which human intellect will be superseded by machine learning. Mm-hmm. And that point dubs it the singularity. That's not the only place the word singularity is used, but he used it, and his goal is his father died, I believe, in his 50s. Mr. Kurzweil wants to live for a much longer time, and he will. He says that he takes supplements, 250 supplements a day. Pardon?
Does he eat?
I don't know. In one interview, I'm not sure, it may have been in the New York Times, his wife is quoted as saying, Ray's very good at taking pills. And he also has a number of IV treatments per week to bypass his gut, so that, gives his gut a rest. So that's the easy question. I don't know. But these are attempts to live longer. And his thinking is if he can make it a number of years beyond now, that he will be in a place where he'll be able to utilize whatever new technologies have come along in order to make it to 150 years or more.
Well, let's just hope he doesn't have an accident that could happen anytime we step outside of our homes.
You are right that there is that risk always, isn't there?
Well, Jerry, we're going to take a break so we can acknowledge our sponsors. And when we return, we want you to dig in more into those issues that you think is very important for us to know. And so you're listening to the Be the People show. We'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to Be the People. Dr. Carol Swain is the mind behind Be the People news, radio, podcast, and YouTube. Be the People's mission is dedicated to empowering individuals to think independently, understand their responsibility, and believe in their unique ability to make a difference in the world. Check out Carol's work at BeThePeopleNews.com. To invite Carol to be your next keynote speaker, go to BeThePeopleNews.com. That's BeThePeopleNews.com.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
I'm back with my guest, Joy Riley, and we're discussing bioethics. Joy, what are the most important things that we should know? Because you've sort of given us an overview. Now, what should we hone in on?
Well, that's a very good question. And honestly, so many bioethics issues are coming fairly fast and furiously at us. And it's impossible to know everything about it. But there are things, there are areas in which each of our lives will intersect with bioethics issues. So I will name three biggies right now. One is human germline gene editing. And basically what that means is being able to, with almost like scalpel-like finesse, being able to use different molecular mechanisms like something called CRISPR. There are a few others, but CRISPR is the most talked about one probably. And using that to do, if you will, surgery on a person's DNA to either take out a portion, which would be potentially disease-causing, or to insert a portion to correct a DNA a problem. And there is human germline gene editing. So the gene editing is what I just talked about, how you use sort of a molecular scalpel to change the DNA. And the germline includes either sperm or eggs. So if you could do this in a person, either as an embryo or at some point the sperm or egg, then you could potentially change all their generations that succeed them in similar ways. And so this is a big issue because prior to this, we haven't had the capability of changing future generations. And there is a committee currently, a combined U.S.-UK committee meeting, and are taking comments from various independent groups in the public regarding how they should go about this. And you may remember that last November, Dr. He Jiankui announced at a Hong Kong meeting that he had done this with twin girls who had been born to save them potentially from developing HIV or succumbing to HIV in the future. And the problem, there are multiple problems with that, with those experiments that he did. But the issue that it brought to the fore is about whether or not we should be doing this kind of research, whether or not we should be changing the genomes, not only of the person before you, but the succeeding generations. C.S. Lewis talked about this in The Abolition of Man, and he said that when you have the technologies like this, he didn't have this in mind particularly, it was not known then, but he described future technologies, an issue with future technologies that could cut out all future men in the shape that we want to do, that we want to cut them out in. In other words, that we could impact the future generations. And that's what we're facing with human germline gene editing.
Well, I know that whenever you make a policy change, like in the real world, there are always these unanticipated consequences. Some are good and some are bad. Most of the time, they're negative, unintended consequences. So are they the researchers and the people that study this fearful that we don't know what the consequences would be for the future generations?
Some of them apparently are, not all of them, apparently, since this has already been done, at least in China. But yes, there are always unintended consequences. And do we know all those that CRISPR causes? No. If you send in a blade into the DNA, can it cut in other places than just the one you want? Well, yes. Can those pieces go back together in a way that you didn't anticipate? Yes. So there are so-called off-target mutations. There are off-target effects. So there are areas of the DNA that could be affected that are not your target. And even if your target succeeds, will you have all the benefits and none of the detriments that you're anticipating? Will there be unforeseen consequences from even what looks like a correct change?
We don't know those. So that's one. What are the other two?
Okay. Another one is also about embryo research. After the 1978 birth of Louise Joy Brown, the first test tube baby born, she was born in Britain. Soon thereafter, Parliament asked a committee to meet and advise them about these new technologies. And that committee, which was named after its leader, Mary Warnock, became known as the Warnock Committee. And they suggested that you could do embryo research up to 14 days after the sperm has fertilized the egg. And that became law in the UK and several other nations around the world. In the US, we have it as a guideline. So it's not a law, but you can't get federal funding after 14 days. For embryo research after 14 days of gestation. So that law and that guideline is coming under scrutiny, and there are a number of people who would like to change it, to extend it, to do away with it. There are a variety of opinions. And one of the reasons is that there are now being formed in a number of labs something called organoids. That's organ with an OID at the end of it. And it means that it's something that looks like an organ, and we're talking human, looks like a human organ, it looks like an embryo even, but it didn't go through all the phases because you've done some molecular switches and changed a few things so that it doesn't go through the usual stages. So if it didn't go through the 14 days and you kind of revved up the engines, if you will, or it's missing some parts, and so it only looks like it, how does the 14-day rule interact with that? And so, of course, if you're doing this, you don't want to have to obey the 14-day rule. You want to go beyond that. Plus, when the 14-day rule was put in place, the ability to culture the embryo, to retain them in culture, to grow them in culture, was only for about 7 days or so. And so 14 days was a long way away, it seemed. And now there are labs both in the UK and the US that have photomicrographs of embryos that are 11, 12, 13 days old. Oh, so basically now you have embryos that they can culture up to about that cutoff. And they and typically they sacrifice the embryos, and so they destroy them. Because they to have them live beyond that is against the law or against the guideline.
But not in
China. So the issue. Not right, exactly. So it depends on where you are. Yes.
And then what's the third one?
The third one I had is basically mixing human and animal genomes. And these are not all the conundrum that we have, all the problematic issues. But should we be about this? Should we be producing chimeras, which has a mixture of different animal, but in this case I'm talking about human-animal cells, and hybrids is where you have basically the joining of the genomes. The hope in this is that they may be able to grow human organs in different animals. But some questions that come to the fore or should come to the fore are, how much human DNA does it take to be human? So if you put some human cells in a mouse or a rat or a chimpanzee or a monkey, how do you treat those beings? What if they go, what if some of the cells migrate to the brain and you have human consciousness? How many cells does it take to produce that?
But isn't
isn't
that actually taking place in China, that it's going far beyond the point of, you know, a few weeks, that they may actually be bringing human, animal, you call them chimeras? What do they call?
Chimeras. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, actually, yes, I think that that there is some, yes, that's true. There was a human animal, a human monkey chimeras in China done recently, and there was some pig ones in human pig in Spain, as I recall. They were sacrificed at birth, and the ones in the human monkey ones, according to Estrella Nunez, that they obeyed the 14-day rule. So basically, you've got, it depends on, like you said, the place where it's done. It depends on location, and there's certainly a number of places where the ethics rules are fairly lax, and China is one of those. You're right.
What, Joy, as a Christian, what bothers me is I see this as the modern Tower of Babel. Because it's as if the scientists are trying to create new forms of life. And they, you know, to me, they're really intruding into areas where we should not tread as Christians. I don't believe that we should. But even as a society, whether or not you're Christian or not, I don't see how we should allow our tax dollars to be used to support that kind of research, no matter what.
That's a great question. Should our tax dollars be used for this? And we need people like yourself who are trained to help us with the policy decisions. But I'm not supportive of this sort of embryo destructive research and the chimera formation. I understand the desire to produce human organs. We have a shortage. There are people who die waiting for organs every day, or their death every day of humans waiting for organs. And that's a problem, and we need to address it. I'm not convinced that human animal chimera is the way to go.
We're going to take another break, and when we return, I'd like to get your perspective on cloning.
Each week, the Be the People show presents interviews with insightful guests from the world of politics, religion, media, and culture. The Be the People show is on podcast. It offers bonus footage. To listen to Be the People online,
go to the BeThePeopleNews.com website and subscribe to the Be The People podcast, heard also on the America Out Loud Network. I'm back with my guest, Jory Riley, and we are talking about some heavy bioethics issues that really should be something that more of us ponder and make decisions about how we're going to use the information that you're getting from this show. And so, Jory, I'm really curious about cloning. We know that they're doing animal cloning. Are they doing any human cloning in countries other than the U.S.?
Well, I'm afraid I can't answer that question, not because of specialized knowledge, but because of specialized ignorance. That's not reported. However, in the early 2000s, one group, CloneAid, reported they had cloned a human and the baby had been born. Her name was Eve, but they never disclosed where that baby was born, and there was no other mention of that. So that that announcement was greeted with some initial horror and disdain and some excitement, obviously, on the parts of the announcers. But there's been no corroboration of that.
There are people who have lost a child. They've lost their only child. And I could see how they could easily be attracted to such research if it was allowable to try to, you know, recreate the child they lost.
Good statement. I understand. Each of us comes to some sort of loss in our life. That is absolutely true. And the truth is, though, even if you did clone the individual, you're not getting that individual back. You're getting a copy, if you will.
Because
if that were possible.
Because environment shape who we are. Because environment shape who we are.
Yes, and not only that, but there are epigenetic changes in the mother's womb. So even though the person's DNA is the same, think about twins, even identical twins. So they have the same DNA. They're in the same mother's womb. They're in the same environment. Yet there are differences between them. Yes, there are many, many similarities, and those are remarkable, but they also have differences. So even in twins born in time, identical twins born in time, there are some differences. And if you were able to clone a human individual, that, say, a few years hence, those few years have made changes in you, and so the environment that child would grow up in would be different. Lori Andrews talks about the right to an open future, so that if you had a child like Michael Jordan, say, and you wanted to have another iteration of that child, Michael Jordan, what's going to happen if that Michael Jordan 2, and I hope Michael Jordan will forgive my using his name in this way, what happens if that child, whom you assume is going to be this incredible star athlete, outstanding athlete, what happens if he's really more interested in music for some reason? What kind of future is this child going to have? So those are some of the thought-provoking concerns that you might have. There are other issues about cloned beings. For instance, cloned animals, typically the babies are larger. Cloning itself isn't easy. Dolly the sheep was cloned in 1996, and she was, I believe, the 277th try. So you had a lot of embryos that were destroyed or died prior to the full-blown baby sheep lamb as Dolly.
Do you know the lifespan of the cloned animals?
Oh, that's a good question. I haven't looked at this over because there are a number of cloned animals. The first dog, I believe, was Snuffy. He was cloned by Hwang Woo-suk in South Korea. There are a number of different cloned animals, so I can't say across the board. I know about Dolly. She was born and she had to be euthanized, I believe, around or so, 6 or 7, because she had some pulmonary disease and bad arthritis. But she was cloned from a sheep that was 6 years of age. And I didn't grow up on a farm, but my understanding is sheep live around 13 years or so. And so if you add her age to the age of the animal from which she was cloned, it equaled about one typical lifespan of a sheep. But her life was obviously cut short. Does that make sense?
It does. And Jory, we're coming close to the end of this show. And I would like to tell the listeners that if you are interested in this topic and you want to hear more of the conversation, you can go to my website, bethepeoplenews.com, or you can go to the America Out Loud Network and hear more of this interview on my podcast. And when you go there, please be sure to subscribe. And so right now, I'm going to give Joy an opportunity to tell you how to get in touch with her or her organization to learn more about the bioethic issues. She may have some books she wants to recommend. And so, Joy, what would you like our listeners to know?
Well, this is a huge field, and we are a small concern in a huge field, but we do provide a place to begin. And so if your listeners would like to visit our website, that is www.TennesseeCVC, and you have to spell out Tennessee. So TennesseeE, C as in center, B as in bioethics, C as in culture.org. You can contact us with any questions. We have RSS feed on our landing page, RSS feed from 2 different bioethics news sources, and so that's updated daily. And if you want to read more extensively, there is on the upper banner, you can click on blog, and there are a host of topics covered, so you can scroll through those. But you're also welcome to contact us, and you can do that through the website. Additionally, we do send out a monthly e-newsletter. It's not hard copy, but that's free to subscribers, but you have to subscribe to it. We don't send you spam mail, and so you can do that through the website as well.
Jory, thank you so much for being on the Be the People show. And for our listeners, remember, it's up to us to be the people who change our nation and our world. You've heard today about a very important topic. Educate yourself about this. And for those who would like to hear more of my interview with Jory Riley, then go to my website, bethepeoplenews.com or America Out Loud, and you can hear more of my conversation with Jory Riley. Thank you. I'm back with my guest, Jory Riley, and we're going to talk about another topic that was not covered in the radio show, but will be covered here on the podcast. It is about organ donations and transplants. So, Jory, what's your opinion on these topics?
Thank you, Carol, for asking. I remember when I was a medical student and I got called in the middle of the night because I was on call for the urology service. And the urology service was the one responsible for organ kidney transplants. And so at 2 a.m., I'm in the OR when this young man, a teenager, was getting a new kidney. And when the kidney was put in place and the clamps were taken off, it pinked up and it was a beautiful sight. And everybody in the OR was so excited. And we were very excited. That was my first introduction to organ transplantation. And it was a wonderful event in many ways. And I fast forward a number of years, and I've looked at this topic in some depth. I have a review in cyberspace on the book called Transplantation Ethics by Robert M. Veach, who's a powerhouse in the ethical realm, particularly regarding transplants. But the reason that there are several reasons I'm continually interested in this. A friend of ours actually gave a kidney to an unrelated family member, unrelated because it's through his wife. And so we walked with him through that process. But there are many sides to organ transplantation, and the one side that's getting some attention now, at least in Britain, and I think we as Americans need to be looking at this closely, is the procurement of organs, the taking or getting of organs to for transplantation. We in the U.S. have an opt-in system. You have to sign up to be a donor, and I think it's fine to be a donor. You need to know what you're signing up for, and your family needs to know. So that's another subject. But how do we get the organs in the first place? So in the U.S., we have an opt-in system, and the U.K. is just now going to an opt-out system. That means when you die, the government has written a law that says when you die, if you have not opted out, then your organs can be procured to give to someone who needs them. That's already in place in Wales. It's going into place in the spring in England, and then later in the autumn in Scotland.
I've had personal experiences with one or two family members, a brother that was attacked violently, and the doctor said he was brain dead, but they were so eager to get his organs. And we know that there are some countries where they are kidnapping people, taking their organs, selling their organs, that they have this huge business in human organs, and they actually take the organs of people who have no ability to resist. And there are huge incentives for healthy people to sell an organ because they're poor.
Yes, absolutely. There was a teenager in China who sold a kidney for an iPad, I think, and an iPhone. And then sadly, I'm quite sure that same young man came to need dialysis later on. I would have to look back at that case. But yes, this is an area fraught with problems because you've got a precious organ which is being used as a commodity.
And sometimes I believe that the organ is more valuable to the researchers than the life of that person that may be in the hospital, because in one particular case in my family, we said no to turning off mm-hmm. the machines, and the person recovered. They said the person was brain dead, they would never recover. They recovered.
Well, your experience is not, it's important, it's not singular in the sense that you aren't the only ones who have experienced such a thing. Okay, do you understand what I'm saying? That that there can be pressure to donate, to pressure to procure the organs. And I think we have to be very careful about what is the goal of the care. Is the goal of the care to take care of the person, or is the goal of the care to take care of the organs? And those are sometimes not the same goals. And so as family members and as individuals, because we will all be patients at some time or other, usually, we have to be aware of what the goals are, and that needs to be clear. And so I'm glad that your family member recovered. I'm very glad. I would hope that would be the only case in the world, but I would not believe that. If you want to read something sort of popular press that is quite informative, Daniel Asa Rose wrote a book called Larry's Kidney. It's about his cousin's trip to China to have a kidney transplant. And there's debate about what's going on in a number of places. China is one where it's not clear the origin of the kidneys or the organs sometimes. That that will probably get some traction to your website, Carol, sorry. And as you point out, sometimes people, there are reports out of India of people being kidnapped, if you will, and their kidneys taken from them, one kidney taken from them, and they wake up and they have this big scar. They didn't know what was happening.
And sometimes they kill the people. It's not just that they taking the kidneys and giving them a surgery that they didn't ask for. In some cases, the people whose organs are stolen end up dying or being killed in the process.
True. And that can be true. And I don't want to scare people to death about organ transplantation, but it is fraught with some difficulty. There was a that can happen even in controlled situations. It's rare, but it does happen in controlled situations. And so you can imagine if it can happen in controlled situations, it can certainly happen in uncontrolled situations where people are doing surgery on the sly, if you will. So, yeah.
So is there any danger of America becoming an opt-out society where if we don't opt out, they would take our organs when we die?
There is a movement for that, certainly. And in the UK, the reason that is given by the NHS, if you look at their organ donation website, I don't have that in mind right now, but if you need that, I can get it to you. At any rate, they take some pains to assure the public that they're not going to take your organs when you die unless you're typically in an ICU setting, a hospital setting, an ER setting where they can do this. So they're saying, well, it doesn't apply to everybody. But the reason they wrote the law was they said that there are, I think, 411 deaths per year of people on the waiting list. We have far more people on the waiting list. So then their waiting list, obviously, when we have a larger population. But so they did this on the basis of 411 deaths per year. And I'm not saying that those people should die. Please do not hear that. And I'm not negating the importance of 411 lives lost per year. But it seems to me it's a governmental overreach. And will our nation follow suit? We often have followed the pattern for the UK, and like the 14-day rule, we sort of followed that, although there were some intimations of that before in our country before the Warnock Commission or Committee. So will we follow suit? I don't know, but I think we as a nation, we need to think about that. We need to talk to our family members. When New Jersey signed into law, I think it's called the Patriots Law, some years ago, they basically accept anybody who is comes to the DMV and signs up, and that includes the young people, teenagers, who can sign up to be organ donors. And I think it's laudatory that they want to help. I'm not sure they understand all the ramifications of it.
Well, Joy, in the minutes that we have left, is there anything that you would recommend for people that are listening? What decisions do we need to make about whether or not we would be a organ donor, or what to do with our family members if they find themselves in that situation?
Good question. I basically have a durable power of attorney for healthcare. Now, this cannot be used as legal advice. You certainly wouldn't be good to get legal advice from a physician. So,
no, but I just want you to give our listeners something to think about, and these are weighty topics, I believe.
Exactly. So basically, but the reason I've done the durable power of attorney for healthcare is because there may be a time when I'm not capable, I'm not cognizant, I'm not able to make decisions about healthcare for myself. And so I've talked with my husband about my decisions. I've talked to my children about what I like and what I don't prefer. And my statement to them is, I'm fine with organ donation, with donating my organs, if I am finished with them. But I want my husband to, or my family members to, as much as they can, realize that I am finished with them. And then go ahead and do and donate my organs. But if there's a question that I'm not finished with them, then no. Does that make sense?
It does make total sense to me. And Joy, I really appreciate having you on the show today. The information is so important for Christians. We do have to debate, understand these issues about ethics, and also know what scientists are up to using our taxpayers' dollars. And so my word to my listeners is, under our Constitution, it's we the people. We the people are responsible for the policies, the politicians, what we see taking place in government, how our tax dollars are being used. It's up to us to be the people who change America and change our world.